Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, where I run through the current version of my Sunday sermon. Before we finish off the Ten Commandments, we should go back to where we started, which is the beginning of the book in Exodus. And we were back in August when we started this, with Israel in slavery to Egypt. And if you had asked an Israelite to identify the source of their misery, it would have been the Egyptians who enslave us. And it would be a very fair point. Now, God comes along, reintroduces himself, shows up in a burning bush, sends in Moses and Aaron, and smites the Egyptians, the horse and rider thrown into the sea. The evil Egyptians get what they ask for with Pharaoh's hardened heart. And the Lord carries them out on eagle's wings. You wonder where Tolkien gets his eagles from in Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit. And the story is that the hero wins the girl. And now it's time to live together. It's time for Sinai wedding vows. Israel says she'll do everything that the Lord asks. Okay. As the old preacher line goes, you got Israel out of Egypt, but can you get Egypt out of Israel? It's a much tougher thing. Physical exodus was the first step in liberation, but in many ways, much more direct, let's say, than the deeper liberation that has to be won for Israel and Israel has to accomplish. And in many ways, that's the story of what Christians call the Old Testament. Now, the Ten Commandments, we've sort of been paraphrasing them as we've gone. They come in a very logical order, and there's these 10 words. And even though you can find other ancient Near East legal codes, there's nothing really that can compare to these 10 commandments. You shall have no other gods before me. That one's straightforward to announce, but as Israel will find, difficult to live. Don't create a representation from creation of God and worship that. Don't lift up God's name upon a lie. Try to leverage God's reputation in order to cheat someone or something. Keep a weekly witness to the goal of creation, which is Sabbath rest, and we talked about that a number of weeks ago. Prioritize your love of neighbor to the most godlike neighbor. Not the most godly, the most godlike. That's your parents. Don't commit murder. Don't commit adultery. Don't steal. And these laws 5 through 9 sort of follow their own little order about loving your neighbor. Do not steal your neighbor's life, which is murder. Do not steal your neighbor's wife, which is adultery. Do not steal your neighbor's person, kidnapping. Do not steal your neighbor's good name or reputation. Do not steal their good name from them. Do not bear false witness. Now, many of these commandments are physical and verbal, and things which are physical and verbal are sometimes relatively easily accomplished. Do this, don't do that. Once you sort of get the community around it, well, you can reinforce it and get it going. But one of the things that we've seen throughout this is that, well, there's the letter of the law and the spirit of the law. And throughout this series, some of you might have been noticing, this was a way for me to bring in the Heidelberg Catechism. And I think this is a strong area of the catechism talking about these commandments. Now, as Christians, if you, again, you follow my sermons, misery, deliverance, gratitude. These are not tools we use to save ourselves. These are ways that we can live in grateful obedience for what the Lord has done for us. And again, Exodus comes before Sinai. That's sort of the flow of this. And again, commandments 1 through 9, well, psychological to be sure, but physical and verbal often quite directly. Don't bow down before those statues. Don't do this with your hands. Don't do this with your lips. But again, as I said, the Heidelberg Catechism keeps broadening it, and Jesus does later too, about what you do with your hearts. And that brings us to the 10th commandment. Some people have noted that one of the ways to understand Jesus' treatment of the law in the Sermon on the Mount, in the book of Matthew, is that he applies the Ten Commandments to all of the rest. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. You shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male or female servant, his ox or his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. Now, when we use this word covet, it's this fancy word that is some sort of sinful wanting, but the Hebrew word itself is just desire, take pleasure. And so, in fact, there are many places where things are noted as pleasurable and rightly and goodly so. And there are times when, in fact, God covets things. Genesis 2 and 3, the Lord made all the kinds of trees to grow out of the ground, trees that were pleasing to the eye and good for food. You might find Old English trees that were covetous to the eye. When the woman saw that the fruit of the tree was good for food and pleasing to the eye and also desirable for gaining wisdom, and there's that word again, she took some and ate it. So in many ways, the word itself is, might we say, a neutral word. It just is as it is. And commentators have noted that, well, it all depends towards what it is, towards what the wanting pursues. And I was sitting down to ponder illustrations for this sermon, and the 1981 song Jesse's Girl by Rick Springsteen just jumped to mind. I wish that I had Jesse's Girl. And those of you who are at least probably around my age, just naming the song will have it going in your head. I wish that I had Jesse's Girl. You want something that someone else rightly possesses. Now, wanting, of course, is a natural thing. And what do I mean by that? Nature, physis, to grow. Wanting just sort of grows and desires, and you see something, and, well, can we be liable for just doing what comes naturally? Woody Allen, of course, in speaking about as he marries his stepdaughter, the heart wants what it wants. Who can argue with the heart? And in fact, we want people to want. These little illustrations from a video clip of Jordan Peterson talking about young men who won't grow up, indulged by their parents in an affluent society and spend their life playing video games. There's a sacrificial element in maturation. It happens whether you do it or not. You need limitations in many ways. You have to say no. Something has to stop. Otherwise, you become this old infant, and the parents start to wonder, well, we thought our son was going to do something with his life. Yeah, he's doing something. He's playing video games or drinking. That's all he's doing. We want people to desire and to motivate them and to desire more for their life. But it's a tricky business. Where is this desire legitimate, and where does it get problematic? Douglas Stewart, in his commentary, says this: although it may seem to be belaboring the obvious to say so, the final commandment insists that God's covenant people realize that wishing to have good and proper things is good, but that wishing to have the wrong things is bad. What people wish for is a major what wish for has a major role to play in what kind of society they create. People able to curtail their wishing so that it is limited to things they should desire are people who contribute good to a society. Those who want what they cannot properly have undermines a society's moral fiber. The commandment has no penalty attached. Improper coveting is hardly enforceable by human beings. God here calls for his people to take an approach to their neighbors that respects them and their possessions, an approach they must voluntarily agree to if they want to please him. Now, the Catechism is interesting in this because what do you do with this? Well, take a look. What is the aim of the 10th commandment? That not even the slightest desire or thought, contrary to any one of God's commandments, should ever arise in our heart. Notice how it takes the commandment and sort of folds them on to the rest of the commandments. Rather, with all our hearts, we should always hate sin and take pleasure in whatever is right. But can those converted to God obey these commandments perfectly? And you can see the Heidelberg Catechism sort of rounding the corner in its misery, deliverance, gratitude. No, in this life, even the holiest have only a small beginning of this obedience. Nevertheless, with all seriousness of purpose, they do begin to live according to all, not only some, of God's commandments. And here's the sense that to break one is to break all, and that they all sort of cohere and hold together with respect to love of God and love of one's neighbor. Since no one in this life can obey the Ten Commandments perfectly, why does God want them preached so pointedly? Well, now we're talking to the preacher. First, so that the longer we live, the more we may come to know our sinfulness, and the more eagerly look to Christ for forgiveness of sins and righteousness. So right away here, there's a sense of the development of time, that as we grow older, we become more sensitive, more realistic, more understanding of our futility, that many of these desires that we have pursued, well, they haven't finally fulfilled us. And many of the desires we should have pursued, well, we really should have gone after them. Second, so that we may never stop striving and never stop praying to God for the grace of the Holy Spirit to be renewed more and more after God's image. So there's something we ought to pursue. In older age, we get a sense of where we've gone wrong, and we get a clearer sense of where we've stumbled, and that this, in fact, would drive us more to the Lord, the source of all good things. Until after this life, we reach our goal, perfection. So, in other words, it's at the our lives in this world will be this continual struggle. So we're supposed to preach pointedly, we preachers. What are we supposed to do? Now, for many, believe that sort of the Bob Newhart in that sketch that he had, that Stop It sketch, which you may or may have seen. He was a five-minute, $5 therapist, and someone would come in and explain their problem to him, and they'd sit there and wait for some long, in-depth analysis, and he would just yell, "Stop it!" And they would say another thing, "Stop it!" And then he would threaten them. And, well, there's a lot of stop it preaching out there and a lot of stop it preachers out there. But for the most part, I don't find that this works. Because, well, don't desire this, desire that. Well, our hearts aren't quite that direct. People just don't talk people into this. As Woody Allen says, the heart wants what it wants. Well, what on earth do you do with the wanting heart? Rene Girard, some of you have heard of before, he gets into this whole question of wants, and he says, you know, these wants don't just come out of nowhere, they come out of the life between us. The heart wants what it sees other people having. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife. It's interesting that the commandment isn't just about coveting in general or coveting bad things. It has a list of actual things that in all likelihood, Israelite men would pay a lot of attention to because, well, there's a value hierarchy and certain wives and certain fields and certain animals and certain homes, well, they run up the hierarchy. And we see throughout the Bible, this kind of wanting gets into trouble. Cain wanted the kind of attention the Lord seemed to give to Abel. King Ahab wanted Naboth's vineyard, and his wife Jezebel says, "You're the king, take it." David wanted his neighbor's wife, Bathsheba, and he took her. Jesus, well, the religious authorities wanted the popularity that Jesus seemed to have, and, well, they killed him. In many ways, there's a one-word treatment of this sin. It's envy. It's wishing your neighbor's disaster because of what they rightly have. Now, the thing is that societies have long recognized this, and because if we find people attacking other people for what they have, suddenly we feel unsafe. If we attack our neighbor, the rest of the community rises up to attack us because they fear someone else will come for them. And we use violence to stop violence. And you can see this play out in Judea and Rome. Judea covets Rome. Rome has power. Rome has supremacy. Rome, in fact, is occupying their land. Look at Roman freedom and Roman power Come down to us, Lord, and liberate us just like you did to Exodus. Come with plagues, come with destruction. And so the Lord comes, and John the Baptist is in anticipation of plagues version 2.0. The axe is laid to the root of the tree. But Jesus changes the script. Jesus won't take up Satan's tool. This fruit is desirable. Why don't you take it? Jesus doesn't. Judea and Rome unite to kill Jesus, who won't play by either's tune. And Jesus becomes a scapegoat. And, well, Herod and Pilate became friends that day, the Gospel of Luke says. Jews and Gentiles alike saw that, well, the Son of Man died at their hands. Jew and Gentile learned that their mimetic desires have gotten them nothing but blood. Now, many Christians have thought about this for many years, and one Christian, Thomas Chalmers, wrote an essay, The Expulsive Power of a New Affection. There are two ways in which a practical moralist may attempt to displace from the human heart its love of the world, either by a demonstration of the world's vanity, so that the heart shall be prevailed upon to simply withdraw its regard from an object that is not worthy of it. It's sort of the sour grapes approach. Or by setting forth another object, even God, as more worthy of its attachment, so as that the heart shall be prevailed upon not to resign an old affection, which shall have nothing but succeeded it, but to exchange an old affection for a new one. In other words, to just simply say no, stop it, don't do it, doesn't really work. What works better is that there be a new love, that there be something more desirable than the thing that you thought you really wanted. My purpose is to show that the constitution of our nature, the former method, is altogether incompetent and ineffectual, and that the latter method will alone suffice for the rescue and recovery of the heart from the wrong affection that domineers over it. In other words, love the Lord your God, and then loving your neighbor will follow, rather than wanting all of the things that your neighbor has. It's interesting, the self-authoring program, some of you will recognize it, has dual components. You need to flee from the calamity that your current attachments are leading you towards. That provides a degree of power. Your dreams of using power to satisfy your borrowed desires, and you need a more powerful desire for the future to displace that borrowed desire. As Augustine said, my heart was restless until it found its rest in you. We see this in the Apostle Paul. But whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. A little question and answer on the Discord server, and someone mentioned, how could the Apostle Paul change his life so thoroughly? He had been a respected member of a community. He was zealous for the Lord. He had the approval of his people around him. And by any measurable way, his life got worse, not better, after Jesus appeared to him on the road to Damascus. Why would he change? Because he clearly saw something in that vision. He clearly saw something in that life. He clearly saw a new picture of the world that displaced the old picture of the world and drove him into a new reality. For whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost nothing. I have lost all things. Now, for some of you, this might not grab you. This might not hold you, because Christ isn't particularly real to you. Jesus isn't particularly real to you. The witnesses you've seen it haven't been particularly potent. They haven't grabbed you. Maybe you're avoiding some things in the past, but you're not quite sure what to run to. Well, how do you get there? Well, you get there by going into Christ. Well, how do you go into Christ? You go into Christ by looking into Christ himself in terms of the witnesses to him, but also the community of Christ. And that community is partly living here in this world and partly dead back in history and, well, with their Lord awaiting the second coming. So to lean into him, to want him, to desire him, to find him so beautiful that the other things, although they may be good things, I'm sure your neighbor's house and your neighbor's wife are just fine, especially if you find them desirable enough to look away from your own, but have this one compelling desire to draw you and to focus you and to bring you into him. I consider them garbage, that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and the participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow attaining to the resurrection from the dead. He sees something so beautiful in the story of Christ, in who Christ is, that he wants to be like him. He wishes to follow him, and by following him, participating in the story, finding this to be the best way to live, the most meaningful, the most fruitful, the most joyful, even in the midst of suffering. And so he throws himself into that. Now, for some of you, that might be a difficult thing. Christ might not be particularly real to you. His kingdom might be rather fuzzy and foggy to you. Well, probably what will happen is you will bottom out on the other end first. You will get what you want. You will get what you ask for. Maybe you'll lose your own home in chasing your neighbor's wife or your neighbor's house or your neighbor's field or your neighbor's car or whatever it is that your neighbor has that draws your attention. And maybe at that point you'll begin to realize the vanity and look for a love that can't be exhausted by anything in this world.